Welcome to JFK Spotlight on Health. This is where we highlight the groundbreaking work being done at JFK University Medical Center in Edison, part of the Hackensack Meridian Health Network. And joining us on JFK Spotlight this week, we're very happy to have Dr. Wiley Lopez, spine surgeon at Hackensack Meridian Health, JFK University Medical Center, also a grad of Rutgers, Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, and residency at Harvard. Good morning, sir.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciate you being here. We want to pick your brain for all the knowledge that you have in spinal surgery. But let's talk about there's a misconception there, I understand, between being a spine surgeon and being a neurosurgeon. And I guess I guess I could probably define the two, but you'll probably do a better job of doing that.
Yeah, you know, this is one of the things that I get asked a lot, especially by my family members, but certainly by patients as well. There are generally orthopedic spine surgeons and neurosurgeons, and there's a lot of crossover between what we do. The biggest difference really falls to where and how we trained. Orthopedic surgeons, for example, we do a five-year residency, which is, you know, where we learn to become orthopedic doctors. Within that training, we do orthopedic trauma, which is like broken bones. We do pediatric surgery, hand surgery, joint replacements like hip and knee replacements. We rotate on tumor rotations where we operate on cancers, and we do some foot and ankle. And then there's a separate rotation for spine surgery. And you do, you know, various rotations throughout the year for 5 years. And so throughout the 5 years, you get a little bit of everything. The people who decide to pursue spine surgery as a career, they end up doing an additional year of what we call a fellowship. So that's your specialization training. And for orthopedic surgery, we generally do one full year of spine specialization, and, you know, for a grand total of 6 years. But one of those years is totally focused on spine surgery. The neurosurgeons, on the other hand, they train for 7 years, and they do spine surgery rotations as well as brain surgery. So that's the big
There's the difference, yeah.
Orthopedic surgeons do not do brain surgery. So instead of brain, we do bone. Some, but not all, neurosurgeons end up going into a fellowship for spine. Mm-hmm. In which case, just like orthopedics, it would be an additional year. So they would have trained for 8 years total. Again, as an orthopedic spine surgeon, you know, I can still do general orthopedic trauma. So somebody comes into the emergency room with a hip fracture, I'm very happy to fix their hip. And neurosurgeons, on the other hand, somebody comes into the emergency room with a brain bleed, you know, they are very capable of doing that kind of surgery. For the spine specifically, you know, there's a bunch of overlap, and a lot of what we do is interchangeable. So it's kind of in the details of how we're different and sort of the things that we're able to do other than spine surgery.
So you do a little bit more and they do a little bit more, but you don't touch the brain.
We do not touch the brain. I'm happy to leave that to my neurosurgeon colleagues.
Could you?
I could not. I have never been trained.
Not a chance.
God, no.
Okay.
I realize that there is a bone around the brain. But that is one of the bones that we orthopedic surgeons do not touch under any circumstances.
The skull.
The skull.
Right. Okay. You don't touch the skull. All right. So you go down into the spine and everything that is attached to that, I guess you'd say, when it comes to orthopedics.
My realm stops at the first vertebrae just below the skull. Let me rephrase that.
Okay.
There is one type of surgery where we do a fusion that occasionally we can fuse people to the base of their skull, but that's the extent of kind of the skull-based work that orthopedic spine surgeons do, fusion surgeries to the skull.
Okay, well, I have the fusion on the agenda, so let's. I was going to have that later on in the program, but let's jump to that since you mentioned it. Fusion is when you're going to give a better example of that, but my understanding is that you just take two vertebrae and you fuse them together to accomplish what?
Right. So oftentimes that's for stability purposes.
Right. Okay.
Something has happened to the patient where, for whatever reason, you know, that vertebral segment is no longer stable. So it's moving abnormally in a way that can cause damage to either the spinal cord or the spinal nerves. Normally, when we do a surgery, we do some kind of decompression surgery, also known as a laminectomy, and or a fusion surgery. It really depends on what the patient is being seen for. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The decompression type surgery usually revolves around removing bone that's or overgrown tissue that's kind of impeding into the spinal canal and pressing the nerves.
And this is causing pain or lack of mobility or both or one or the other?
It can be all of the above.
Okay.
It really depends on how severe it is. Most people are dealing with, you know, shooting pain, whether that be into the arm or the leg, and that's often referred to as sciatica.
Right.
It can also cause weakness, numbness, tingling. It can cause changes to bowel or bladder function. There's a whole constellation of things that can happen. But generally speaking, the way to treat that is to remove some of the bone or whatever the tissue is that's causing those symptoms, that's pressing that nerve. A lot of times we can get away with just doing a decompression, which is that laminectomy surgery, take the bone off.
Mm-hmm.
But in certain situations, the act of doing that, removing the bone, can create instability in the spine. So we are forcibly causing instability in order to treat the problem. When that's the case, that's when you would need a fusion surgery. Okay, and the fusion surgery is adding screws and rods to the spine to recreate stability. Sometimes we can even do these fancy little inner bodies, which are like cage devices that we can put in between the vertebrae, which will help with the fusion. The fusion really depends on what part of the spine we're working on and what the pathology is.
When it comes to instability, what does that look like? Someone can't stand, they can't, are they wobbly? What's the, what happens with that?
So usually when there's instability, there's pretty bad pain. For example, somebody, you know, falls off a roof, they sustain a fracture, right? And because of that fracture, their spine is now unstable. So if we get an x-ray, you know, the bones are not lining up at all how they're supposed to look. Either there's a big fracture through it or there's a dislocation. It's usually fairly obvious. I don't think I've ever seen a patient who has frank instability who doesn't have pain. Now, you don't necessarily have to have had a fracture to have instability. In some cases, arthritis can cause instability. It's a little bit more subtle. And usually, when it's the arthritic component that's causing that instability, it has another name. That's a really fancy name. It's spondylolisthesis. Most people won't remember that.
Say it again.
Spondylolisthesis.
Spondylolisthesis.
Listhesis.
Listhesis.
Yeah, spondylolisthesis. And when that's the case, we normally take special x-rays where we have patients bend forward and come back up from the into an extension position, and you can physically see the vertebrae moving. It's not supposed to, you know, slide on each other like that. So when that's the case, typically these patients will also have shooting, you know, leg pain. And in those instances, you know, we do a decompression and a fusion surgery in order to stabilize that moving segment. So to answer your question, I can't think of a situation where a patient would have instability and not have pain. They usually go hand in hand.
Now, during your schooling, how many classes were required before you learned how to spell spondylolisthesis?
I still don't know how to spell it.
Talking with Dr. Wiley Lopez, spine surgeon at Hackensack Meridian Health, JFK University Medical Center. Let's talk about your good old-fashioned back pain. I have back pain. I don't know where it's coming from. At what point am I going to be visiting with you? Obviously, I'm not going to you first, correct?
Not necessarily, but you could.
But possibly, okay.
Let's be honest. Back pain is probably the most common injury in the entire world, right? At some point, everybody's going to have back pain. And actually, it's one of the leading reasons to see a doctor every year. I think it's actually number one. A huge majority of the time, back pain is due to the muscles around the back. So it's muscular in nature.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually due to some kind of muscle strain or ligamentous sprain. Sometimes even the covering of the muscle, which we call the fascia, can become inflamed, and that can cause back pain. And that has a special name. That's called myofascial pain.
Too many new words today for
There's
me.
A lot of new words, which is why, you know, why we have the MD, you know? So a lot of these things can contribute to pain. Also, arthritis can contribute to pain, right? As we get older, we begin to develop arthritis. There's really nothing we can do about that.
Mm-hmm.
And in your spine, you have joints, just like your knee, just like your elbow, just like your ankle. You know, every level of the spine has two joints. They're called facet joints. These joints, just like every other joint, can become arthritic, and that can also cause pain. So really, there's a lot of different reasons to have back pain. But a huge majority of the time, it's going to be a muscular-type problem. Really, any doctor can treat back pain, depending on which kind it is. But when it's a muscular-type back pain, it's usually pretty obvious. And that kind of back pain can usually reliably be treated with anti-inflammatory medication. So we're talking, you know, ibuprofen, Motrin. Depending on how much pain the patient is in, we can write, you know, a prescription-grade anti-inflammatory.
Mm-hmm.
And then along with that, we normally do several-week course of either home exercises or physical therapy.
Okay.
Right? So I can make, you know, 80% of the patients that I see with back pain better with just mild medication and physical therapy.
Is the medication really a remedy, though? Isn't it just masking the pain?
Yeah, so that's a good question. The idea there is that the medication will reduce the pain and allow the patient to do physical therapy with less pain. So when you're able to do physical therapy more effectively, then you're more likely to get better because the gold standard, the treatment for most of these issues is physical therapy. They do a lot of the job for me, believe it or not. When the spine surgeons become really important for back pain is when there's additional symptoms. So shooting leg pain, weakness, numbness, tingling, that, you know, sciatica that you often hear.
Mm-hmm.
When that's accompanying the back pain, that usually means, you know, there's probably something a little bit more sinister going on, like a pinched nerve, okay? Very, you know, rarely there are some instances where back pain in of itself could be needing a spine surgery. And we're talking people who have, you know, infections or tumors. That's pretty rare. That's a very small percentage of the people that I see. There are also people, you know, we talked about instability a little earlier on in the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
There are also people who, if they have instability from that crazy word we talked about, spondylolisthesis, then their back pain could be from that instability. So those last patients are all people who may need surgery for their back pain, but I would say that 80% of people will get better with just medicine and physical therapy.
And a spine surgeon like yourself, you would take care of the pain, whether it is the spine, orthopedic, the nerves, or the muscles.
Correct. And, you know, that's part of the, you know, coming in to see me and doing a physical exam and looking at all the imaging. You know, within a couple minutes, it's usually fairly obvious what the problem is. Most of the patients that show up to the emergency room have, you know, back pain, maybe a little bit of shooting leg pain. Let's say, for example, you know, they herniated their disc a little bit. There's degrees of disc herniations. So if you herniate your disc, you're going to have back pain and shooting leg pain usually, right? The shooting leg pain comes from that disc herniation poking out and pressing on the nerve. So these patients, you know, even though they have a disc herniation, they can still get better with just some medicine and some physical therapy. Now, if they come back to me, you know, I usually do that for about 6 weeks. If they come back to me in 6 weeks and they say, you know, doctor, I'm not getting any better. I actually feel worse, or I feel exactly the same. This didn't really help me that much.
Mm-hmm.
Then in those instances, I would get some more advanced imaging, something like an MRI, right? The MRI would show me all the anatomy of the spine, show me all the nerve roots, show me if there is a big disc herniation or something else, you know, pressing on the nerves. And with that more information, we can tailor the treatment to, you know, what their pathology is. So this guy who comes in with the disc herniation, who has the shooting leg pain, who's not getting better from therapy or who's not getting better from, you know, the medications, then we can try something like an epidural steroid injection, which is, you know, a procedure where we put the medicine directly onto the nerve root. That happens under anesthesia. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways that we can go, really depending on what the pathology is. But usually you can save the spine surgeon visit for if you're having shooting leg pain, or if you're having weakness, numbness, tingling, mm-hmm. or changes to bowel or bladder function. The back pain thing, I would say you can be treated by a primary care doctor initially with the medicine and the physical therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not better, then the next step is to get an MRI and to see a spine surgeon.
9 times out of 10, the initial attempt will work, or what's the percentage there?
I would say about 80% of the time, you know, that initial treatment works. And it also really depends on what their pathology is, right? But if it's something, you know, very run-of-the-mill, like a recent injury or like arthritis changes that are causing, you know, either the back pain or the nerve pain, most people, 80%, get better. That last 20%, we can usually make better, you know, via something else that's not surgery as well, like an epidural steroid injection. Sometimes we can try acupuncture. Sometimes there's specific types of physical therapy that can make people better, like dry needling or something called Graston therapy, which is, you know, basically a very strong, like, deep tissue massage. So when the first line of defense doesn't work, there are a bunch of other lines before needing, you know, spine surgery. And just to get back to your question, I'd say 80% of people can get better at some point before they reach that spine surgery line.
The epidural, is that a one-time thing, or is that something that you have to do on a regular basis?
So normally we can try two epidurals before we consider them a failure. And the epidural is normally for people who have shooting arm or leg pain. So, you know, we find a specific nerve root that's being compressed, and then we have, you know, usually one of our pain management physicians go in with a little needle and spray medicine right onto that nerve root. And usually they're spraying a steroid, which is a very powerful anti-inflammatory medication. So that medication is going to bring down the inflammation and usually take the pain away. For a lot of people, I'd say about 50, 60%, that's the end of it. But in a lot of people, it can come back. And so we would try that again. And if the patient comes back after two epidurals and say, you know, the pain is back, it feels exactly the same, that's usually when we would indicate somebody for surgery.
I guess the surgeries vary.
The surgeries vary completely depending on what the pathology is. But for the most part, spine surgeons are doing some kind of decompression, which is, you know, the fancy term is a laminectomy. And we're trying to decide if a fusion is necessary. So those are really the two main things that we're doing, you know, on the days that we're doing surgery, either laminectomy and or laminectomy and fusion. And or just a fusion.
How about in a chiropractor? Do you ever recommend anybody to a chiropractor?
I do. Yeah. You know, I think for chiropractors, I would send people to them for very specific situations. You know, people who are having, you know, muscular type back pain can oftentimes be made to feel better by a chiropractor. People who have disc bulges, and that's different from a disc herniation. A bulge is a much more mild form of that pathology. And oftentimes, you know, some manipulation can make people feel better from a disc bulge. I'd say the instances where I would tell people not to go to a chiropractor is if they have, you know, a frank disc herniation in their neck, or if they have some kind of fracture or some sign of instability anywhere, then I would say avoid a chiropractor, because if they manipulate you, they can make things worse. And a lot of how they treat is through manipulation therapy. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, generally speaking, I like to have advanced imaging on someone who has shooting pain before I'd recommend a chiropractor to them.
Okay. Getting back to the surgeries, what would be like some of the most common, based on, I know there's, as you said, there's many different surgeries that may be required based on the pathology. What would be the most common one that, you know, someone comes in, you're like, oh.
So it's a majority of what I treat is what we call degenerative conditions. So these are pathologies that arise from arthritis, basically. Mm-hmm. Okay. As people age, tissues become, you know, bigger than they once were in response to arthritis changes of the bone. And that usually results in compression of a nerve. For the most part, you know, most of these patients are going to be treated with some kind of a laminectomy, which is a decompression surgery. But it really depends on which part of the spine we're talking about, right? If it's in the cervical spine, so your neck, oftentimes these patients are getting a fusion no matter what, because you're much more likely to cause a problem with a laminectomy, just a decompression surgery, in the neck that creates instability. So from the start, a lot of people end up getting a fusion in the cervical spine right away. And the cervical spine is one of those places where we can actually come in from the front and do the fusion. Most of the spine surgeries that we do are coming from the back, right? But mm-hmm. with the neck surgery, we come in from the front, we kind of move the esophagus to the side, and we can go after the discs that way. For younger people, you know, who have big disc herniations who don't have arthritis, sometimes you can do a disc replacement surgery. So that's more of like a motion-preserving surgery, so they have better motion after. And if there's ever a chance where I can do that kind of surgery and it's well indicated, I would much prefer that, because if I can ever spare somebody a fusion, I would preferably do that. With the fusion surgery come other problems, right? You change the biomechanics of the spine. Mm-hmm. You change the way the next level above or below that area of the spine moves, and it creates problems there that can ultimately lead to further surgeries down the line.
And more than just being less mobile, it could lead to other problems.
It can lead to breakdown of the next level, And if that level breaks down and starts to press the next nerve, then you're talking about an extension of your previous fusion.
In regards to the spine, what are some things that you can't do now, but that you foresee being possible in the future or in the near future? Let me tell you why I'm asking. When it comes to paralysis, you know, we can mend, we can fix bones. There's all kinds of things that, doctors can do, but it seems like what causes, I mean, I know there's probably several different reasons, but what causes paralysis? And then why haven't we come up with some sort of fix for that yet?
It's usually a direct injury to the nerve and a direct injury to the point where, you know, those cell bodies just outright die. And we haven't figured out a way for those to completely regenerate. In some instances, if you cut, you know, a certain part of the nerve, it can regrow, but that takes a really, really long time, and it doesn't always happen. It really depends on how, you know, how the injury occurred. For paralysis, like in someone who had a neck injury, it's usually the trauma and the resulting inflammation that kills those nerves, and we haven't figured out a way to regenerate that. I think there is a lot of interesting stuff happening with regenerative medicine and with physical therapy and neuromodulation, where that kind of stuff is going to start becoming possible for sure. I think there are already have been some baby steps, especially with, you know, people who are needing prosthetics and who can kind of, you know, get limbs back by neuromodulation. That's already starting to happen. So I think we're still a long way away from, you know, having someone recover fully from paralysis. But that's certainly, you know, one of the new horizons in spine surgery. Another really interesting technology that's actually being used a lot now that's going to continue to improving is augmented reality in spine surgery. So we can physically put these goggles on while we're doing surgery that can give us a 3D representation of what's happening underneath your skin, right? So I put these goggles on and I step over the patient when I'm in the surgical field and I look down at their back before I make an incision and I can see, you know, where all the anatomy of the spine is. So then I can tailor my incisions to be more precise, or I can do, you know, screws and rods through much smaller incisions because I already know where that anatomy is. So it's almost like having like a virtual reality headset on and looking at a person and being able to see their insides, you know, while they're laying there. And in this case, the insides, I'm referring to the bones of their spine. And that's just going to keep getting better. So pretty soon we're going to be able to see all the fine anatomy of, you know, of their discs. There's some versions of this where you can see all the blood vessels and all the nerves. I know the neurosurgeons use a version where they're working on the brain and you can see all the blood vessels around it and all the really complex anatomy of the brain. So this stuff is making surgery much more, you know, fine-tuned, and it's allowing us to do a lot more interesting, minimally invasive work, which I think is the future of, you know, the more minimally invasive you can be, the more you can preserve patient anatomy, the better they do.
And other people, other doctors, nurses, even the patient could put on a pair of goggles and watch you do that, right?
Yeah, so a lot of these headsets are linked. So, you know, when I was training in my fellowship, the physician surgeon that was training me, who was doing the surgery, I could have a headset on and he could have a headset on and I could see what he's doing through my headset.
Right.
So, and if I'm doing stuff and he's trusting me to, you know, do a procedure or do a part of the case, he can physically see what I'm doing. Or, you know, not that it happened, but if, you know, if for instance, you're a young surgeon who's, you know, out trained or practicing now, and you wanted a senior, you know, more experienced surgeon to sort of watch what you're doing to make sure it's okay, they can be down the hall with that same headset on and see what you're doing.
Right. They don't have to have the headset on, right? They can watch on a screen?
In some instances, you can see what's happening on the screen, but the whole point of the headset is so that you don't have to look at a screen.
Okay.
Right? So you don't have to shift your visual field away from the patient, because in some instances, you know, that can lead to an error in of itself, right? You put your hand somewhere, you look away, and your hand moves a little bit without you realizing it.
I got you.
So that's where the technology becomes really interesting. You never have to look away. And, you know, that creates a lot of interesting potential for training and education and, you know, improving the way that you can give instructions to training, you know, surgeons. And not only that, but it also improves your ability to do minimally invasive surgery. And, you know, when you can do minimally invasive surgery, patients are often recovering faster, losing less blood, spending less time in the hospital, and that all comes back and is just favorable for the healthcare system.
All right, we'll leave it at that. Dr. Wiley Lopez, spine surgeon at Hackensack Meridian Health, JFK University Medical Center, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate the opportunity.
Dr. Wiley Lopez. If you'd like more information, go to jfkmc.org. If you'd like a podcast of this show, you just go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com. JFK Spotlight on Health, brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better. I'm Joel Katz. Talk to you in a week.